morning, and welcome to the Morning Exchange on Voice Corps. My name is Annette Lutz, and I'm with the National Federation of the Blind of Ohio, and I'm very glad all of you are able to join us this morning. It's almost spring-like here in Columbus, Ohio. I can't believe it. After some of the weather we've had over the last couple months, this is wonderful. They say it's going to rain, but you know, I can almost live with the rain if it's in the 60s in February. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the weather we had and some of the impact that it has had on some events that's taken place in the National Federation of the Blind when we get to our introducing our guest and our topic for today. But before that, I want to just let some of you know on some of the happenings that's happening around the National Federation of the Blind. First of all, as part of the NFB of Ohio, we are about to have our winter board meeting. This is going to be a virtual meeting. Everybody is welcome. The board of directors for our state affiliate do get together several times a year. Between conventions, it is the body that make some of the decisions and keeps the processes of the Federation kind of moving along. This meeting will be on Saturday, February 28th at 10 o'clock a.m. It is on Ohio Zoom. So all the phone numbers that are normally affiliated with Zoom, you can access that. And as always, our Ohio Zoom room code is 408-185-0851. I will try to repeat that later in the show. Any event that is held as part of the Ohio State affiliate in our Ohio Zoom room always has that code. So it's one handy to keep around. We do quite a few different meetings and events via Zoom. So that's one that you'll want to keep and keep handy. For things like the board meeting and things like our Sharing Solutions, which is an event held every month by our seniors division. So those of you who are 50 and older, who are interested in just all kinds of topics facing blind seniors and maybe not seniors. A lot of them are of interest to anybody. They have a monthly program. It is Sunday nights, the third Sunday of each month at 7 p.m., and it is also in that same Ohio Zoom room. So our senior division would welcome you to that. I'm not sure what their topic is upcoming this month. I don't remember, but they always have great, great topics. Everything from cooking to gardening to shopping. Sometimes they're just pastimes, hobbies, anything that you can think of, they have had an event and a topic as part of their Sharing Solutions event. And then we are so excited. We're getting ready for our upcoming conventions. First of all, in July will be our national convention, July 3rd through the 8th in Austin, Texas. I am going. And I know my daughter's going. Misty's been on here before. We're excited to go. And we're going for the whole thing this year. So looking forward to that. And I invite all of you to come check it out. We'd love to have you in Austin. Registration for that will be next month. I'll have some more information on that on our next show. But for right now, just maybe put it on your calendar. And if you can't get to Austin, I know that's hard for a lot of folks to make the commitment to go. I've not been able to go many, many times. We will have some virtual element to that where our general sessions, the banquet, things like that will be available to you. They're in the comfort of your own home. And more information of that will be forthcoming as well. And then way off in the future, but boy, it'll come before we know it. It always does. Will be our state convention. It's going to be in Dayton, Ohio. So a little more central this year at the Dayton Marriott there by the University of Dayton campus. So looking forward to this. November 5th through the 8th. So another thing just to put on your calendars, a lot more information will be coming up on that as well. Well, on our last show, I mentioned about our Washington seminar, and I shared with you how excited I was that I was going to be participating in my very first Washington seminar. This is an event where Federationists from all over the country go to Washington, D.C. and meet with our congressional representation about certain topics that are of interest to blind people in the Federation, things that we want Congress's help with. And I promised you we would have a show all about Washington Seminar, and I was excited to share with you my experiences. Well, I will tell you that I have, first of all, a couple fellow Federationists on here to help me tell you what happened, which is Christopher Sabine and Shane Popplestone. I'll give them both a chance to introduce themselves here momentarily. But the three of us were part of the expedition to Washington, D.C. Unfortunately, the expedition didn't happen. Mother Nature and airlines all had different ideas. The days that we were supposed to be leaving was the same days that the big old snowstorm Fern showed up and grounded flights from here to Washington and all over the country. So none of us actually made it physically to Washington, D.C. But Washington Seminar went on, and we were able to participate, and we're going to tell you a little bit about that. So Christopher, Shane, welcome to the show. I'm so glad both of you were able to be on here with us this morning.
You're glad to be here.
Great. So... best laid plans of mice and men, they say.
Right. Exactly.
We were all planning on, we all had our flight scheduled. We all had hotel reservations made. All of us had plans to be in Washington, D.C. with our fellow Federationists. And not a one of us made it there.
No, and you know, some of us tried so hard. It's Shane Popplestone. And so yeah. a lot of us tried so hard. I was at the airport, literally at security, and was watching this flight just get pushed farther and farther. And then I called poor Annette as I was turning around. I was like, I'm done. I'm done. I'm not doing it. She's like, well, what happened? And I explained it to her, and she's like, go home.
Yeah, go home. Absolutely.
Get home. And that's exactly what I did.
We had 8 people as part of our Ohio delegation. We had one person, Ken Shuttella, who actually made it to Washington, and only because he was there early. He had some other events to be there for earlier in the weekend. But none of the rest of us were able to make it there. But in true Federation spirit, that didn't stop us from having Washington Seminar. We went forward with it. So... tell me a little bit, Chris, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about yourself before we get into our Washington seminar experience, and how often have you done Washington seminar?
Yes, most definitely, Annette. I have been a member of the NFB of Ohio since 2013. I'm actually secretary of the Cincinnati chapter. I joined in 2013, as I mentioned, but have been familiar with the Federation and its activities for much earlier than that. I've had relationships, connections with some of our founding members of our affiliate going back into the 90s, people like Barbara Pierce and Paul Dressel, and those are names that some of our listeners may be familiar with. I, as I mentioned, I'm secretary of Cincinnati chapter. I've been to several, I believe it was my 11th state convention, and one national convention, and this is my second Washington seminar. I'm also secretary of the Ohio Vendors Representatives Committee, which is the committee that develops policy for blind vendors. So I'm actually going to be in Columbus on Friday for that process. And I also operate my own business supporting families of children with optic nerve hypoplasia.
Absolutely. What about you, Shane? Tell us a little about yourself. I should notate that Shane is our current Gnarls Garwood Award winner that he was presented at our last convention. So I want to recognize that. And so you have done a lot with the Federation in order to win such a prestigious award.
Thank you so much. And it was my pleasure and honor to win the award at last year's state convention. For those who don't know me, my name is, of course, Shane Popplestone. I've been the member of the National Federation of the Blind of Ohio since 2021. I attended my first state convention in 2022. In 21, I'm sorry. And then attended my first Washington seminar in 2022. And then my first state convention, national convention, actually, in 22. We were in, is it Houston in 22? I don't remember. It was Houston in 22. And I've been... I was president until its dissolution of the Ohio Association of Blind Students until its dissolvement in 2024. I'm a member of the Guide Dog Division as well as the Greater Akron Chapter, and I do a lot of our technical work when it comes to the website at nfbohio.org, which puts me on the communications committee. I'm also our newsline person. As a part of our communications stuff, I'm also on the legislative committee along with Annette and the rest of our team for this year. So it's my pleasure to be here. And thank you once again for having me on the show.
Oh, very glad both of you are here. So let's talk about Washington Seminar. Usually it begins on a Monday. This year it was Monday, the 26th of January. There's some training events. There's actually some pre-events where we do some mock interviews and presentations that we'll talk about that here in just a minute, what our presentations consist of. But the first major big event is the Great Gathering Inn. Now, both of you have gotten to be there in person, and I've been told it is very convention-like.
So the Great Gathering Inn is an event, a very great event. We all get together in the main ballroom of the Holiday Inn Capitol Hill, which is where our it's where the seminar has been held for years and years and eons. It's always where that has been, and we gather, and the president gives a speech, Mark Riccobono gives a speech, or whoever the grand president is. And we talk about the issues, and we just have, as Annette said, yes, it is very convention-like. It's a smaller scale than a convention. We normally have between 300 and 500 people packed in that room, and it's a great time had by all. I could tell this year, while the energy was there, you could definitely tell it was a smaller type gathering this year in person, but the Zoom room was packed as well. I did see the Zoom room was definitely fully loaded with seminar attendees who could not make it. I think when I talked to Kyle just after the seminar, I think it was last week, I think our numbers in person were 245, and we had 375 Zoom attendees this year. So it was everybody represented that was there.
Absolutely. And the speech that President Riccobono gave at the beginning was great. It was almost like a little mini banquet speech for those of you who have listened to some of his banquet speeches. I believe it is posted on nfb.org, our national website.
Yeah, I believe it's on the Washington Seminar page. I can check, though, and give a quick further note if it's up there or not before the end of the show.
Okay. That'd be great. So I encourage everyone to listen to it. It was very good, very inspiring, as his speeches pretty much always are. And I was fired up, even though I was sitting in my recliner and not in the room there. I was fired up for it and was looking forward to what we were planning on for the next couple of days of presentations. So, Christopher, do you know some of the history of why we do Washington Seminar? I know I kind of threw that at you, but why do we get together every year?
Washington Seminar was originally established back in 1973. I believe it was by our former longtime president, Ken Jernigan, as a means of communicating our priorities and our needs and our interests to lawmakers and Capitol Hill, members of the House, members of the Senate. This is the kind of thing that originally came out of some very successful meetings in the earlier decade in the 60s, in which our previous presidents, we actually in 1965, I believe it was, had a very successful engagement at our national convention in which President Lyndon Baines, President Johnson and his staff attended, and I believe it was RFK Jr. attended, very successful, it was in Washington, D.C. And it was by that point we had developed and we had been successful in passing our White Cane Law in 1964, which is the impetus for the White Cane, the White Cane Safety Day, now White Cane Awareness Day, in October that we celebrate as part of the Blind Equality, but now it's called Blind Equality Achievement Month. But that whole impetus, and Washington Seminar was part of that, essentially, in the 1970s. And we have been meeting at our flagship hotel, which is the Capitol, the Capitol in Washington, D.C., since. And so really the format of the Washington Seminar really dates back to that time and has been pretty much constant, really, since its inception in 1973.
Oh, that's great. And we know that building those relationships with our congressional representation, the issues are very important, and we're going to talk about our three issues, but maybe even more important than the issues is just building that relationship with our representation, letting them know that the National Federation of the Blind is here, that we are advocating for the rights of blind people, and that we're doing it for ourselves. These are blind people doing this. So we're showing them that we are the ones advocating for ourselves and demonstrating our abilities and our care for these issues as blind people. So every year, there are usually about three different issues that the Federation brings to Congress as part of Washington Seminar. Now, all throughout the year, other things come up and we support some things or we may be against some things. But at Washington Seminar, we typically focus on three different issues. And this year was no exception. And the three ones were, we have the Access Technology Affordability Act, the Blind Americans Return to Work Act, and Protecting Education, Employment, and Independent Living for the Blind. And I'm going to have these fellas almost do a presentation on each one of these for you, similar to what they presented to their representatives when we were, quote, in Washington, virtually.
quote, in D.C.
Yes.
Exactly.
Chris, do you want to get started? You want to do Access Technology Affordability Act and tell our listeners about that?
Yes, most definitely. The Access Technology Affordability Act was actually introduced by Representative Mike Kelly in Pennsylvania and Representative Michael Thompson out of California, both on the Republican side and the Democratic side. I believe this was last year. It was in February of last year as H.R. 1529. And also has a companion bill in the Senate, Senate Bill 1918. And essentially, this is a priority that has been on our books for a number of years in the Federation. And really the issue here is that assistive technology is very, very expensive. We need a lot of very specialized equipment, screen readers, assistive technology, braille displays, and other types of services like visual interpreter services to be able to function in our daily lives, become employed, become employable, be successful in a job, participate in the community, pretty much everything is online right now. You have I had to buy something on Amazon this morning that I needed for a health related issue that I'm dealing with. I had to use a website that required a screen reader called Job Access with Speech, or JAWS. Many of you may be familiar with JAWS or use JAWS. And this software is very expensive. It can cost upwards to $1,200 to $1,500 for the professional version of JAWS, which is sometimes absolutely necessary even to navigate websites, especially complex websites like Amazon, for example. Websites are getting more complicated. And the other issue is, too, is Braille displays. The common Braille display, or the typical Braille display, can cost upwards to $5,500 to $6,000. I use a Mantis Q40, and some of you know, if you're familiar with blind vendors in particular, I have to be in Columbus once a month to take meeting minutes for our policy committee meetings that we have for blind vendors for Randall Shepherd. And to do this, I have to record the motions, and I need access to a Braille display in order to do this. That Braille display is something I had to purchase for this job out of pocket in July of 2024. It cost me $2,900. And this equipment, pretty much, if it weren't for veterans benefits and some specialized stuff that I got at the VA, from the VA after my father passed away, survivor's benefits and what have you, I would not have been able to afford this particular Braille. It's a Braille display and a note taker. And 61% of blind people are unemployed, I believe the statistic is. And part of the reason why blind people, the unemployment rate is so high, is just because the assistive technology that we need to participate in society at the level of our peers and get employed, become employed, access websites, access information online, is so expensive and it's so specialized. And what this law would do, the Access Technology Affordability Act, would institute a 3-year refundable tax credit of up to $2,000 for the purchase of assistive technology. So even if you don't necessarily pay taxes because you're unemployed, you don't have taxable income, you would be able to file a tax return and have that deducted, so that you can have your the $2,000 at least of this technology deducted, and feasibly getting a tax refund based on the purchase of this assistive technology. This is a law that the national organization, the NFB, actually hired the services of Mathematica, which is a very respected policy analysis firm. And they came back and told us and analyzed this legislation, and they came back and basically said that it would save the federal government $315 million in FICA taxes, Social Security taxes, et cetera, because it's actually integrating blind people into the workforce and giving them the tools that they need in order to be successful, instead of essentially requiring them to rely on benefits to like Social Security and SSI and Medicaid to survive. This is the kind of support that is, unfortunately, health insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, private insurers do not cover. They only cover medically necessary services. They operate on a medical model, which essentially operates, if you have mobility needs, or if you need assistive technology to work just because you have a disability, then you're probably not worth being in the workforce anyway. To be very blunt about it, that's pretty much how the medical model operates and has for a number of years. This is a law that would sunset, that would essentially expire in 5 years. And this would allow Congress to determine the cost effectiveness and the impact of this legislation and the law and its impact on our economic interests and the cost to the federal government. So this would be a law that would operate on a temporary basis. So far, I believe this law has 45 co-sponsors in the House. It has four co-sponsors in the Senate. And I will conclude my presentation on this legislation, rather, by stating that one of our congressional representatives in Cincinnati, who is a very beloved family member, who was a special education teacher, Greg Landsman here in Cincinnati, has signed on to this law, as well as our other piece of legislation, the Blind Americans Return to Work Act. And so he is a co-sponsor, and we have been able to get him to co-sponsor this legislation, and he is also a supporter of our priorities in National Federation of the Blind. So I do want to mention that.
Oh, that's wonderful. It's great when we have our local representation sign off on this, because that demonstrates the relationships that we have built with our representatives. They know about the Federation, they know about blind people, and we're here to continue that. And when they sign off on this type of legislation, it really demonstrates the force of that relationship. So that's great. Very important act. This stuff is so expensive, but yet so necessary. I'm a fairly new user to Braille displays, but in the short time that I've used it, it has become a very integrated part of my life and how I do things, from work to even just jotting down recipes. Screen reader. And one thing I do want to point out for those of you who are low vision, it's not only for things like screen readers and JAWS and things like that, but Zoom text and magnifier, CCTVs, those type of things as well could be a part of this.
That way.
So we appreciate it. Thank you, Chris. That was great. And I'm hopeful this one can go through. We do have a companion bill, so it's in both chambers, and be nice if we could get this one done. So that being said, we have a lot of other things too. We have one that's not really a particular bill that is before Congress, but it is asking for Congress's support on vital programs that are already a part of many of our lives. We're entitling it Protecting Education, Employment, and Independent Living. And Shane, you want to tell us some about this?
Not a problem. Thank you so much. So basically what we're doing at this point, we're urging Congress to protect those critical programs for education, for employment and independent living programs, basically to ensure their continuance. Let's start with the I'm literally just going to take this from the law since we've got the time. Normally at our presentation, we wouldn't do this, but I'm just going to read this as it was written because I think the information here, since we have the time, unless Annette tells me otherwise,
No, go ahead.
the information here is really critical. So I'm just going to read what they wrote for us. So the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, known as IDEA, was an initial thing that became law in 1975 as the education,
Education for All Handicapped Children Act.
Okay, hang on. Sorry, my brother's way. The Education for All Handicapped Children Act. Congress reauthorized this act in 1990 and officially changed its name to the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA. For 50 years, this law ensures that all American students with a disability receive a free and appropriate public education that is tailored to our individual needs. Without appropriate funding, the administration of IDEA programs, blind students will be left behind. And as I've always said, our students are the up and comings. We need to
Yeah.
support those students. That's our job. Not our job. Our is that job the right word?
Our
Our
obligation.
obligation. Thank you. I was like, there's a word there. We're obligated to support our students. I'm all for the students. Always have been, always will be. The students are gonna be doing what we do right here, right now.
Yes.
You know, and that's why this act needs to continue to be supported. Because we, without this, students won't have things like IEPs. IEPs are individual education plans. I almost call them programs. Individual education plans. And you know, without those, students won't get things like textbooks in Braille and stuff like that. The second thing is the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. This act basically strengthened vocational rehabilitation, prohibited discrimination in federally funded programs, and established the Rehabilitation Services Administration. Later amendments to the act also included mandates for federal information technology accessibility. This landmark legislation served as a predecessor to the Americans with Disabilities Act in 1990, that was also known as the ADA. Without appropriate funding and administration of the Rehab Act programs, blind Americans... Hold on.
We
will not... There we go. Receive the skills training to make themselves job ready. Sorry about that. My Braille display was being a little bit difficult. Okay. I apologize for that. So that's another very important thing, because rehab is important. Vocational rehabilitation is very, very important, because as I just said, without that, people won't be job ready. And we want our blind Americans to be job ready so that we can be in the workforce all the time, because you know, in the workforce, we're not relying on other benefits such as SSI. Well, SSDI and SSI are great things to have. You know, working age blind Americans should be working. The unemployment rate of blind Americans is really high. I believe, what is it, Annette?
61%? Yeah, unemployed or underemployed. And you know, we want to be like everyone else. We want jobs to support our families.
Exactly. So, you know, that's the second program. Let's carry on to the Randolph Shepherd program. This is a program that was signed into law in 1936 to create employment opportunities for blind entrepreneurs by establishing a priority for operation of blind vending facilities on all federal property. For nearly 90 years, this program has served as a major boon to the employment of blind Americans who already suffer from an unemployment and underemployment rate that is significantly higher than the national average. Without appropriate administration of the Randolph Shepherd Act, a program, sorry, blind entrepreneurs will lose valuable employment opportunities. And Annette, you're a part of this program. I can't really, I'll be honest, you know, I've read about this act, I've read about the program, but Annette, how about you speak to that particular section as you're a part of the program?
Well, this, in my opinion, is one of the largest opportunities for blind people out there. This is a program just for the blind. I am a part of this program. My career, getting close to 30 years now, is in Randolph Shepherd. Actually, if you count, before I was a Randolph Shepherd vendor, I worked in one of our facilities as a cashier. Prior to this program, I was a single mother on welfare. This program took me off of welfare, off of SSI, and has given me a career. I cannot speak highly enough of what this program has done for me and my family. My husband is also a blind vendor. Our daughter just got licensed So she's hoping to get her first facility here soon. My mother works in a facility, so this has just been essential to our family and many, many other blind families throughout the country, and we want it to continue. We need it to continue.
So let's do the fourth out of five is the older individuals who are blind OE OIB program is a federal program that was created by the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 as part of the Rehabilitation Services Administration. The goal of OIB is to focus on independent living for blind and low vision Americans who are over the age of 55 and may need help learning how to live with their vision loss. Critical aspects of OIB include orientation and mobility training, learning Braille, cooking, and training on access technology. Without appropriate funding, the administration of OIB programs, older blind Americans are at risk of living sedentary and solitary lives in their golden years. So basically, what this covers is their older seniors who may have gone blind older. So without this program, they will be, basically relegated to, things like nursing homes and stuff like that. We don't want that for our older blind citizens. We want them to continue to live the lives they want, as we say in the National Federation of the Blind, living the lives they want, and that is what this program will continue to allow them to do. The last program is the American Printing House for the Blind. A lot of you may know that program, them as the company in Louisville, Kentucky, for education in Braille, and the American Printing House for the Blind. They were founded in Louisville, Kentucky, in 1858, and they are the oldest and largest nonprofit organization making accessible materials for the blind. They first received their first federal support in 1879, and to become the national producer of Braille textbooks, maps, and educational aids. Most recently, APH began distributing the Monarch, the first dynamic, tactile and multi-line Braille tablet. And without the appropriate funding, the APH will be unable to produce and distribute Braille textbooks and education aids for blind students. Now, let me tell you the fact, I am originally from Canada, as some of you who have heard me on the show previously may remember. I am originally from Canada, and APH isn't just an American, doesn't just help Americans. I have received materials produced by APH in my Canadian schooling when I was in school in Canada. So they're not only supported, the national company here in the US, but they're international as well. They support those of us in other countries, and books and stuff that I have gotten have been produced by APH. So they, without the appropriate funding, this organization will not be, will not be able to do what they do and they have done since 1858. Those are the five different things that we're asking Congress to protect this year. And Annette, thank you so much for allowing me to make this presentation.
No, thank you. These are laws that have been established. They've been around a long time. Obviously, Randolph Shepherd, Shane mentioned, since 1936. We're celebrating our 90th anniversary this year. But these are ingrained in the lives of blind people. And the reason why we're going to Congress about these this year is, there's a lot of talk. Anyone following the news, we know there's talk about dissolving the Department of Education. Many of these programs are through that department. So we just want Congress to know, hey, if the Department of Education does go away, if there are changes, or even if it doesn't. We want these, we need these different laws to stick around. If they end up in a different department, well, I guess that's so be it, but we need them to be here, and we need them to be funded, and we need them to be administered, because we don't want any blind people falling by the wayside, whether they're young students or our elderly or anyone in between. We need these to continue. So however the future looks in the federal government, we just want our congressional representatives to know that these are vital and they need to stick around.
You know, with APH being, you know, with APH being around since 1858.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Losing them now would be, that'd be rough.
It'd be devastating. It would be, you know, all throughout school. I remember getting Braille materials or recorded materials even at the college level. And that's what helps our folks to be competitive. Without these programs, you know, like I said, the students would suffer in school. They wouldn't get materials. They wouldn't get Braille instruction. They wouldn't, they'd be sitting in a corner with who knows, not the support services that they need in education in order for them to become educated and competitive adults. People would lose job training, lose their jobs, and then our older folks would be almost relegated to nursing when they want to be like everybody else and live independent, happy lives at home. The blindness should not be a reason to go into a nursing home. That is definitely for sure. So we have one other initiative that we presented to Congress today, and that is the Blind Americans Return to Work Act. And Chris, do you want to tell us about that?
Most definitely. Thank you for the opportunity. The Blind Americans Return to Work Act, and this is another one of our priorities that has been discussed, and we have actually been advocating for this for, I believe it's 8 to 10 years, and we were able to have this law, or this piece of legislation, we were able to have this bill introduced in February by Representative Pete Sessions of Texas, who has been a longtime advocate of ours on the Republican side. It was introduced last February as H.R. 1175. We're fairly sure that this would be, that there's a pretty good chance of passing and actually becoming law. And essentially, the issue with Social Security has to do with Social Security, SSDI, that there are essentially two federal public benefits programs that exist here in the United States that a lot of blind people have access to and receive. One of them is Supplemental Security Income, which is for essentially people who have low incomes, or for people who have, I believe it's less than $2,000 or less in what are called countable resources, which is basically the not only income, not only money in the checking account, but also tangible assets are also included, your car, a house, so on and so forth. So it's people with less than $2,000 in resources or assets, essentially. And it is public. It is funded over general revenues, and essentially it's an income maintenance program. The other benefit, a primary public benefit that's issued federally, is the Social Security program, which essentially, Social Security program was established back in 1935 by the FDR administration. It was actually initially proposed as part of the New Deal, as, you know, the first 100 days of the Roosevelt administration during the Great Depression. And essentially, it's an insurance program for people who are, if they retire, they're unable to work, they can receive retirement benefits. But there's also another program, Social Security Disability Income, which essentially is an insurance program for people who become unable to work due to some type of a disability. And blind people fall under that umbrella. And blind people typically, we actually have our own separate category of eligibility for Social Security with the Social Security Disability Income Program, or what's called SSDI. There are two different categories, blind and disabled. And this particular law, the Blind Americans Return to Work Act, specifically deals with recipients who are blind. And that actually came up because there are a lot of members of Congress and a lot of congressional staff and people in D.C. who do not agree with this as a main opposition to this legislation. It only applies to blind people, but as I'll get into in a moment, that is we're doing that because of it being a pilot project. And essentially, I'm going into this detail, number one, because I had the time to do this, because it is an hour program, but it's also sets a context for essentially what we're advocating for. With Social Security in general, the income, how Social Security handles work-related income from a job is very arcane and very outdated and very complex. There are limits. You have to have less than an amount, which was what is called the so significant gainful activity. And in 2026, it's called SGA. And in 2026, that amount is $2,830, 2,800 essentially. But then there's a separate amount, I believe it's $1,150, $1,165, that if you actually make or earn in a job more than that amount of money as a blind person, it triggers something called a trial work period. So essentially, you can make that $1,150 amount every month for 9 months in a 60-month period. Is essentially the idea was it would basically be a period where you can try going to work, try working in a job, and if it doesn't work out, it doesn't change your benefits. But it's 9 months in a 60-month period. So if you work 9 months, if you earn more than that 1100 and something a month, then your 10th month of earning that amount of money, it goes into another period, which is extended period of eligibility, where if you make a significant gainful activity, that 2800 a month for 3 months additionally, so essentially 12 months if you're getting benefits, month number 13, your benefits are completely cut off. And we refer to that as an earnings cliff. And we have had a number of people, and this has been documented in the Blindness Industries program. Again, I'm going into detail on this because of our time. We don't have the time constraints, but
We're getting there, though. We are.
we're getting there
Yeah.
exactly. But
It's fine.
essentially, 13 months, you lose your benefits. And a lot of blind people in National Industries programs have had to turn down benefits, turn down jobs, turn down raises, turn down promotions because for fear of losing your benefits. And it creates a significant disincentive to employment, and it's counterintuitive, and it's taking people out of the workforce, and it's costing the government money essentially because the government is paying people benefits when blind people or the two blind people who have every have every ability necessary, or have all the capability in the world to contribute to society, and be contributing taxpayers, not taxpayers, essentially.
Yes.
And
So,
I mentioned SSI, because what this law would do is it would change the Social Security regulation. It would basically, instead of an earnings cliff where you lose your benefits completely, you would essentially have it like SSI recipients have had for 50 years. And that is, if you make a certain amount of money, they take away $1 of benefits for every two that you make in a job. So essentially, it's a two-for-one program. And that is what SSI, that's been the case for SSI recipients for pretty much since the Reagan administration, if not earlier than that. And it would eliminate the earnings cliff, and it would allow us to be contributing in the workforce in a much more substantial way. And the other thing is, it would be a 10-year pilot program. Actually, it would allow us to, it would allow the government to determine whether or not this program is effective. It would be a pilot program. And this is a piece of legislation that has been approved by the Commissioner of Social Security, Frank Bisignano. He was actually at our national office, and he has signed on to this legislation, essentially. So I wanted to conclude with that. And this is another piece of legislation that Greg Landsman in Cincinnati, who I mentioned earlier, is a co-sponsor of this legislation.
Absolutely. No, thanks, Chris. This is also very important because we want blind people to work. We want promotions. We want overtime. We want things that all other workers want. And when people are fearful, I mean, imagine if you're right around that SGA of that 2830 a month, and you're earning right around that, and you're worried if you make $1 over that. So you have a wage of $2,831. You could lose your whole Social Security, which the average Social Security disability income check is around $1,500 a month. So make $1 more and lose $1,500 is a not much, not anything that most of us could afford to do. That is for sure.
Exactly.
So thanks so much. Well, so those are our legislative initiatives. Those were the things that we presented to Congress. We did most of our representatives. Ohio has, I believe it's 16 districts. We hit most of them. There was a couple that we had some scheduling issues with and all that. But most of them were, we met with both Senate offices. So I think our Ohio delegation for the challenges that we had to undertake with the weather, I think we did pretty good. I'm very proud of us. And I am so looking forward to next year being there in person. I've told folks, I said, hey, by the law of averages, next January, it's got to be 60 degrees and sunny when we do Washington seminar because of what happened this year. So we will see if that comes to pass. Probably not, but
You can dream.
yes, I absolutely can. So thank you to both of you for your participation in this. And I do want to mention the other people who were part of this, our affiliate president, Richard Payne, our director, our legislative director and vice president, Suzanne Turner, Emily Keel, Marion Parker, Ken Shuktella. Was that all of us? I one, two, three, four, five, six. That's it. And the three of us, that was our Ohio delegation who were planning on going to Washington. But we have so many folks also who contributed here locally, too many to mention. But now I do want to mention before we wrap up, we're not done. Even the Washington seminar is over. The follow-up is just beginning. And that's where all of you come in. And that's where why I wanted to have this show and talk about what we're doing. Because these issues, we do not just go tell them about it, leave, and never to be heard from again. There's a lot of follow-up. So learn about these. Our fact sheets are on our NFB dot org website. Go and read them. You got the presentations today. The fact sheets will kind of reiterate those, put them in your mind, the bill numbers as they have them, and follow up with your legislators. They need to hear from you and know that these are important. Write, call, email, do what you can to help these go through because what we want is for these laws to be passed or the ones that's been passed to be protected so that all of us can benefit. So please do that. That it's so important. Anything else either of you wanted to add? We're about to wrap up here in just a couple minutes.
So I did check the website really quickly, and yes, the Great Gathering in YouTube video is up there, and so is the awards presentation that happened at in DC, as well as there's a lot of great information, as well as the fact sheets, of course, but there's also a couple of good mock training meetings that were up there. So, NF, if you're looking for more information on all of these issues, plus some great materials to help you prepare for making your own presentations, nfb.org/Washington-seminar. That's nfb.org/Washington-seminar.
Great, Shane. Well, thank you so much. And thanks to both of you for coming on today. I definitely could not have done this on my own. I appreciate it. Again, come to our board meeting, look into our conventions. We'd love to have you as part of the National Federation of the Blind. We are definitely a membership organization. Our biggest strength is our members. So we are only as strong as how strong our membership is. So come to a chapter meeting. Our information on all of our local chapters is on nfbohio.org. Listen in on our sharing solutions. Again, our code is 408-185-0851 for anything in the Ohio Zoom room, or even just take your toe in the get a little sample of what we are. Come to our board meeting virtually using that code on Zoom. Well, as always, I appreciate all of you listening in today. I will be back on the 18th of March. And until then, remember, you can live the lives you want. Blindness is not what holds you back. Bye, everyone.